Here at Fight the New Drug, we talk a lot about the impact pornography can have on mental health, relationships, sexual health, and the world around us. And if you've felt that impact personally, it's important to know this. You're not alone. That's why Relay exists. Relay is an app designed to give you real support as you work toward lasting change. It connects you with a small, private group of people who understand what you're going through, people who show up when it matters. Relay isn't about shame or judgment. It's about accountability, encouragement, and learning how to move forward together. And if anonymity matters to you, Relay has you covered. No names, just support. If you're ready to stop doing this alone, try Relay for free today at ftnd.org/joinrelay. Can I be honest for a second? A lot of people who listen to this podcast already know they want to quit porn. That's not the problem. The problem is doing it consistently, when no one's watching, when it's difficult, when it's late, when you're stressed. Instead of just relying on willpower, rely on our friends at Relay. Relay gives you structure, tools, support, connection. So you're not fighting alone and starting over every week. If that sounds like what you've been missing, check it out at ftnd.org/joinrelay.
Struggling with compulsive sexual behavior or betrayal trauma can feel isolating, not just for individuals, but for partners and families too. But healing is possible, and you don't have to navigate it alone. From June 25th through the 27th in Nashville, Tennessee, the Hope for Healing Conference brings together individuals in recovery, partners, couples, and professionals for 3 days of expert insights, meaningful conversations, and real connection. You'll hear from experienced voices in the field, gain practical tools for healing, and connect with others who understand what this journey can look like. Whether you're seeking support personally or professionally, this space is designed to meet you where you are. To learn more or register, visit csbdhopeforhealing.org and use code PODCAST25 for 25% off. In today's episode of Consider Before Consuming, we're joined by Zoe Watts, a founder of End I Check and a survivor of drug-facilitated sexual abuse. Zoe shares the devastating story of discovering that her husband had been drugging and sexually assaulting her while she slept, and how it took years to fully process what had happened. She opens up about the emotional and physical effects of trauma, the misconceptions surrounding abuse within marriage, and the online communities built around sharing and consuming non-consensual abuse material. We also discuss the recent CNN investigation into sleep content, the takedown of Motherless, and why Zoe is now using her voice to advocate for survivors around the world. This episode includes discussion of sexual assault, drug-facilitated abuse, coercion, and trauma, so please take care while listening. With that, let's jump into this episode of Consider Before Consuming.
To start, can you introduce yourself and share a bit about the work that you're doing today through End I Check?
Well, yeah, I'm Zoe Watts, and I am a survivor of drug-facilitated rape. It took me a long time to figure out that that's what I was. I didn't feel it, I don't think. I couldn't figure out, you know, whether I was a victim or a survivor. And I think me starting up End I Check has been valuable to that, which at the moment, as it stands, we're focusing on an international campaign for those who have experienced a drug-facilitated rape. And we're looking to tackle safeguarding laws and legislations, laws that make things difficult for women to come forward with policing and through the judicial system. And basically a re-education, not only in schools and colleges, but those who have a mandatory duty of care to report. So it's a big feat.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. And your advocacy work today comes from, you know, a deeply personal experience. As you mentioned, you're a survivor. Can you take us back to when everything first came, you know, to light for you?
Yeah, that was a thing, really. I was aware that something wasn't right, but it wasn't that something wasn't right with me or that something wasn't happening with me. It was my ex-husband. My ex-husband had been assaulting me whilst I was asleep. And on a few occasions, I'd woken up. But he took just enough responsibility to sort of pretend to wake up from a day's sleep and say, oh, gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm so sorry. You know, I hope this doesn't happen again. So through a period of time, he sought out medical treatment, almost as if he was validating what he was doing.
Right.
So at the time, I wasn't aware that I was being sedated, but I had woken up to him having intercourse. Around about 2017, 2018, that he had confessed that what he had been doing all along was purposefully, intentfully premeditating drugging me in order to have sex with me and take images.
Yeah. And did you, when you would wake up, like fully understand what it was that had happened to you? Or is that kind of a realization that had come later?
Yeah. I really didn't compute. I mean, when you're in a marriage and you've already been with a partner, and we had been together for years, had children, to find that you've woke up and you want to experience of a trauma, and oh my God, what's happened to me? But to find a grown man on the end of the bed, like head in hands, going, oh my God, like, I don't know what I've done.
Yeah.
You're not even if it's duty bound, but as a wife, you want to protect your husband. You feel that your husband is protecting you. It never in my wildest dreams would I be thinking that this is a purposeful act.
Right. And if he's providing kind of that explanation and that apology and acknowledgement of what had happened, then it leaves you, you know, wanting to accept that as your partner and wanting to say, okay, this was a mistake, I think is...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just me going to the doctors. As I said, it was he took enough responsibility to say, I would never do this to you, Zoe. I wouldn't want you to wake up and find me doing this. I'm not doing it on purpose. There must be something wrong with me. And he would do all these online quizzes of, was he bipolar? This quiz would give him an 89% chance of him being bipolar, and can he talk to his GP? Or was he a schizophrenic? Or did he have a borderline personality disorder? So he was a very big advocate for that.
Right.
It looked like, from the face of it, that I needed to support my husband, who was on a quest for getting well.
Yeah. And, you know, that kind of speaks to this, but this is something that, regardless of the way that the details of the situation look for so many people who are in, you know, a serious relationship or a marriage, a long-term relationship, it can be difficult for them to kind of immediately recognize abuse when it's happening to them. And why do you think that is, you know, for individuals, especially women who find themselves in this set of circumstances?
I mean, I remember being a 15-year-old girl thinking, if anybody ever hurt me, I'd leave. It was so simple, very black and white.
Yeah.
But it doesn't often happen that way. It doesn't often happen that, you know, you wake up one morning and you've got a black eye and you can leave. The abuse happens slowly. It's as if you're sitting in a bath and the hot water is slowly on. Your body becomes very quickly accustomed to the temperature of which it is in.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the case. Things started very early on. And again, he took the route of taking just enough responsibility. Oh my God, I can't believe what happened last night. I'm so sorry. It must be because I'm grieving. I can't believe that happened last night. It must be because I had a drink. It's very different than if you had somebody sat opposite you very callously saying, I did what I did because I did it on purpose and I'd do it again if I could. No, it's just a dangerously so taking enough accountability, but to never change. For it not to be real, not a genuine accountability. But it, you feel like you're supporting somebody, that you're working in a team, and therefore they would allow you the same grace. Not that you ever would, but.
Right. And especially when it's someone that you love, right? You want to see the best in them, and you want to believe what they're telling you. And so when this is happening little by little over time, it really is so difficult to see. And as you mentioned, you know, when you're not in this situation, it can be so easy to say, well, if this happened to me, I would just immediately leave. But it's really not that easy. And I think for people who haven't found themselves in this situation or a similar situation ever, it's easy for them on the outside looking in to say, well, why wouldn't you just walk away? Why would this? But the truth is, it's so much more complicated than that. And so I'm really grateful that you're willing to have this conversation with me to help kind of shine a light on, you know, the complicated nature of abuse in a marriage, abuse in a long-term relationship, abuse in committed relationships. I want to ask you a little bit about, you mentioned he would, you know, admit to just enough or take responsibility for just enough. When did he confess to what was actually happening?
That was around about 2017, 2018, that we had a church service on the different types of love. And as you said, you wouldn't believe it anyway. You wouldn't believe that this person that you're making the same hopes and dreams with is capable. So when he sat me down and said, I need to talk to you tonight, I thought, oh, okay. It was unusual for him to initiate a conversation like that, but he did. And I didn't think anything of it. I carried on the rest of the day, you know, spent time with the children, put them to bed. And that's when, ironically, he gave me a cup of tea and sat me down and said, you know, I said I needed to talk to you. Well, here goes. And I think this is really important to my processing at the time. I'd already been in a situation where I was aware that something was happening, but not fully aware. That led to a certain level of security. This was already a man that was telling me what he wanted to do together in our retirement when our children were older. So our future making plans were as promised, and we'd had that for the 17 odd years. However, he went on to say how he had had an affair while I was pregnant with who at the time was my best friend. And at that moment, emotionally, mentally, physically, my world had stopped instantly. My whole body thought, you know, that's the husband, father of my children. Is this something I can get over? Is it forgivable? How long does it go on for? And I was in shock from that one confession. I didn't know what to do with it. But my world had stopped. And then when he came forward and made the other disclosures to me, as in boom, 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 just so you know, I put the sleeping medication in your last cup of tea of night. That was then the next thing, that it was almost as if I was deaf. And then I've been doing that to tie you down. Okay, what does that mean? I don't know what to do with that. Why? I've been doing that to take photographs of you. And he sort of put in a disclaimer as if to say the photographs were for my benefit. And then he said, to have sex with you. And my brain was still stuck on that I had an affair while you were pregnant. Firstly, which child? How long has it been going on for? Very cleverly done. But these are clever people we're dealing with. They're hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. And, you know, I think for so many people who haven't experienced this, they could only really imagine the depth of pain that would cause, and disbelief, right? You're sitting there in front of a person that you believed to be, you know, one way and one type of person, and that you knew them and that you understood your relationship, and then just getting disclosure after disclosure after disclosure of all of these things that are so different from what you believed them to be. You know, I can only imagine how absolutely devastating that experience had to be. And then to go back and kind of replay every single moment leading up to that, to truly try to understand what you were dealing with.
With the disclosures, he went on to say, but I didn't know what I was doing. I don't want to be that way. I'm going to get help. You know, it was very cleverly done.
Right. And constantly putting you in a position where almost, you know, if he's a victim in it too, then it's wrong for you to have a reaction, or it doesn't allow you the space to respond authentically with what you're feeling in that moment as well, which is so unimaginably awful. And I want to ask a little bit about some of, you know, the emotional and physical effects that you were experiencing before you had fully processed the trauma itself. So, you know, maybe prior to that disclosure and then upon that disclosure and after, what was that process really like for you with that emotional and physical effects of that trauma?
I think being with somebody in a domestic and sexual abusive relationship, even if you don't realize it, it takes a toll on your emotional reserve. And I feel you live almost in that fight, flight, freeze, fawn moment. And I've learned a lot about that, you know, the power of sympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system. And I recognize now that I was living, and up until now, still living in that state. It was, you know, everything was for him and for his needs. My needs or feelings and emotions, they didn't even come into it. It was as if I was a tool to serve him. So I think that physiologically, apart from being exhausted, almost as if you go from one battle to the other and you just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, you revisit what that looks like for you as a family, you then have to settle, and then it happens again. It's like a wave that just keeps coming in. And then just as I regain some sort of normalcy emotionally, let alone physically, you're hit again. It's as if you're drowning. And that keeps you in a very confused and unstable state whilst trying to parent your children. And you recognise it. You feel like the abuse is just happening to you. But at the same time, you don't feel like you're being abused because you're looking at this person. And while it's confined to this person, we're all okay. We're managing. During the time of the disclosure and leading up to it, I was practically just devoted to this man and his well-being. He would threaten suicide. He would suggest that I would leave him as his family did. Was I going to be like everybody else that disowned him in his life? So there was a huge amount of pressure for me to be that person in his life. And subsequently, his needs and safety came before my own. I didn't recognize I wasn't in an unsafe situation because, of course, he loved me. He didn't want to do it. But after this disclosure, my body became poorly. I'd experienced signs and symptoms before, as in recurrent, idiopathic, non-specific urine infections, regular bouts of thrush, nausea, migraines, confusion, tiredness, which as a mother I put down to parenting very, you know, four children and life, really, and having to deal with somebody who was apparently suffering from a mental illness whilst running a business. So that just seemed like the stress. And you bump into anybody in the supermarket and they tell you how they're tired and exhausted and can't remember anything. So you don't think that it's anything of significance. After the disclosure, I became a recluse. I didn't know why, but I couldn't cope in a very different way. I couldn't cope with seeing people, public places, sleeping, diet. I wasn't looking after myself for the first time. I felt unable to manage. But again, the priority was still on him and his next appointment. But I became, you know, somebody that was requiring, you know, anti-anxiety medications and antidepressants. All the while still living with a man that could equally be raping me every night. And that's a lot to process. It really is. And then I think afterwards, my body was, after the disclosure to my family who called the police, it's taken years to recognize what happened to my body, why I felt the way I felt, and subsequently have been diagnosed with a functioning neurological disorder because my body just crashed. It just gave way. There was such a pressure on being strong and surviving and getting through this. I didn't give my myself time. And one of the things it affects is my speech. I struggled. I had about a year and a half's worth of speech and language therapy as I was unable to speak properly. Confusion of words and numbness on my left-hand side. So there's been a real physical demand on my body afterwards.
And thank you for sharing all of that. I think for so many survivors that we are able to speak with in the work that we do, who are so courageous and brave to share their experiences as you have here, that is something we hear over and over again, are, you know, the slew of effects that survivors are left with because of the choices someone else made. And I think that so often people think, again, well, why didn't you just leave? Or, you know, assuming once the abuser is out of the situation, everything should just be better. But it's really taking a deep look at that trauma and how far those effects go, how long you've been experiencing them, and how long your body and mind have learned to survive with them, and how deeply that affects, you know, every other aspect of your life. I want to ask you a little bit about consent and how your understanding of consent changed as you began to process everything that had happened.
Yeah. When the arrest was made, I remember sitting with the detective at the time, and he was fantastic. And I was almost making excuses about what had happened to me. He was taking it seriously, the only person that really had. And I felt like, you know, you got to remember that you still love these people. I devoted 17, 18 odd years to him. It wasn't going to go away overnight. And so I think that the police officer had to explain to me that if I was asleep or sedated, I couldn't consent. And that took me time to process. It's different. There's no right or wrong. There's no better or worse. But I've said this before. It's, you don't have the same scars. You know, if I had a car crash, I'd be able to point the finger, say, look at that, Wally, you crashed in my car. It's his fault. I think that because of what society had taught me, and even afterwards, a lot of people were saying to me, but you slept with him before. What does it matter? Or maybe if you put out more, Zoe, this wouldn't have happened. Maybe if you were a bit more kinky. So it really blurs the lines of consent, you know, for a woman to have to say, yes, I know I have consented to be with this man many times before, but on these occasions I didn't, and here is why it's wrong. But it did take a long time for me to break down. It helped me because before I wasn't seeing it as a violation and the crime in which it is. It helped me tremendously when he explained that if I was sedated or even asleep, he said, if you were drunk and had passed out on the sofa, you still can't give consent. And that probably did help me.
Yeah. And, you know, we've covered some of the misconceptions already, but what do you think people often misunderstand about sexual violence that happens within relationships broadly?
I don't think they think it can happen.
Yeah.
Just full stop, you know? That choice is taken away as soon as you've committed or already shared your body with that person. It's like an unspoken rule that you can continue to do so, even at times you're unaware or don't feel like it. I really think that that is a big issue.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we've heard that from people as well, being, you know, there are a lot of people who, partially because of porn culture and rape culture and all of these messages that our culture is inundated with, who truly believe, like, you know, she couldn't be raped, she was his wife. And it's like, well, you can be raped within a marriage, you can experience sexual violence and sexual assault and sexual abuse within committed relationships, and as you mentioned, especially even after you've consented to sex on another occasion, and you know that what's been consented to, when it's been consented to, how it's being consented to, just because maybe those things have happened one time does not mean they could happen another time. And perhaps most importantly, as you mentioned, if someone is unable to consent because they are unconscious or incapacitated, then that is sexual abuse, sexual violence, and rape, even within a marriage or a committed relationship. And it's so important that we break any stigma that is happening where people don't believe that's true.
Yeah, I agree.
At what point did you decide to involve law enforcement, and what led to that decision?
Well, becoming very poorly, my family were aware that he had an affair. And I think that's all they thought it was. They weren't aware that he had committed essentially now these other crimes, but to me it wasn't a crime at the time. So I had a few months of that, and I remember I was having a panic attack. So I was on the anti-anxiety medications, and my sister said to me, look, if you can't get over this affair, then you might not be able to stay together. You might have to move on. And I thought to myself, well, it's not just that I'm dealing with. I became so frustrated and so broken that I ended up disclosing to her his other disclosures. And that's when she very quietly came off the phone and must have rung my mum. And my mum rang the police. So that decision to report initially was taken out of my hands. And I've got to say, I felt a bit angry about it. I couldn't believe that they were making such a big deal out of something that nobody else had. Medical yeah. professionals were aware of. I felt, oddly enough, I felt like my choice was taken away. Over yeah. something that was actually safeguarding me. And that's how. But it took a couple of months after the arrest and speaking with the officer for him to explain the magnitude of the crimes that had been committed against me that I then decided to prosecute.
Yeah.
Hey, just be honest for a second. How many times have you said that was the last time you'd watch porn? And meant it? Yeah. You're not alone. Quitting can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Relay is a recovery program that helps you actually break the cycle with structure, support, and real accountability. So it's not just you in your own head trying again and again. If you're ready for something different, head to ftnd.org/joinrelay and try Relay for free.
The Consider Before Consuming podcast is part of a global movement to raise awareness about the impacts of pornography using science, facts, and real stories. And because of supporters like you, these conversations stay free and accessible to millions. In fact, Fight the New Drugs podcast has reached millions of listeners worldwide, helping people better understand how porn can impact mental health, relationships, and society. But here's the thing, this work doesn't happen on its own. Every episode, every expert interview, every story you hear is made possible by donations from listeners who believe these conversations matter. So, if this podcast has helped you think differently, start a conversation, or feel less alone, consider paying it forward. You can support the podcast and the movement by making a donation today. Just visit ftnd.org/donate to give. Because when you support this work, you're helping reach millions more with the information they deserve. Together, let's change the conversation about porn.
And, you know, as you mentioned in that moment, you still have love for this person. And so to have your family stepping in a way that felt like it was taking away your choice to reconcile, maybe if that was something that you were on a path toward, but really seeing how much they were protecting you. You know, what was it like navigating reactions or assumptions from other people during that legal process?
Oh, awful. I had a few very good friends that I'm still friends with today who were my oxygen. Most of the other people sucked it out of me by, you know, launching vicious campaigns. My children were being bullied. He had, you know, posted, been, he was able to be very vocal on social media to set his version of narrative. But as a victim, you're so scared to say the truth because it can be used against you in court. So I would be in shops with the children, and I remember this one occasion, this woman just tore strips of me in the middle of Pets at Home, which is a big like pet store in nationwide here in the UK. And I was standing there with the trolley with kids all around it, and there her and her husband and her children were. And I found it really hard to navigate, it, very untrusting yeah. of who I could and couldn't talk to, who I could and couldn't let in my life.
Right. Because the assumption from all of them, based on the narrative he was spinning, was that you were making it up, or is that kind of where it came from for them?
Some of it was that he was just poorly, mentally ill, and I was stopping him from seeing his children because he was a brilliant dad. He was dating again. So I had his new girlfriends would message me that I was making it up, or the best one was in court and before that, that I wanted him to.
Wow. And, you know, speaking of being in court, what was it like sitting through a legal process where you had to hear how he tried to explain or justify what he had done?
Well, I mean, I dreaded it. And that was another reason why I questioned whether to prosecute or not. This wasn't, and it's awful, awful. It wasn't one act on one occasion. I was warned that my history of my sex life with this man would be brought into question, of which it was. I think they said to me something like, well, if you've used handcuffs in the past, you know, have you used them? If they insinuated that because I'd ever used handcuffs in my entire marriage, that I was basically asking for it. And you just think, you know, you remember every intimate transaction, every conversation, every joke that could be taken out of context. And you just think, oh my God, I'm not going to get through this. Because it's very much like he's innocent until proven guilty. You're guilty of accusing until proven innocent.
Yeah. Which is a devastating way our systems are designed, I think, to prosecute those who do, you know, perpetrate harm, and really speaks to why so many survivors don't speak out, because they're met with constant disbelief. And, you know, you were very young when the relationship began. Looking back now, are there dynamics that you understand differently today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'm still processing that. I still think, oh, God. It yeah. comes to something when your eldest son tells you that you were groomed, you know, by his yeah. father, essentially, the 11-year-old older one met. Society has changed very much on that front.
Yeah.
But it still has a lot of work, a long way to go. But I do think that he found somebody that was young, impressionable, naive, innocent, and use that to his advantage. And looking back, his treatment of me in the relationship, as the years went by, it was as if he just pushed the envelope, that the level
yeah.
abuse was able to escalate. You know, like at what point, how many years of fantasy did it take him about doing that to me at night before he put it in motion? You know,
right.
You just wake up and choose to do it.
Right.
And I think that the whole industry, there are a lot of facts to say this, I'm sure, but it does have a long way to go for them to be strangulation sites, CNC sites. Why is that sort of material even being made? I think there's definitely a culture that I'm more aware of now that wasn't ever present in my mind before.
Yeah. There's certainly an abundance of content on very mainstream porn sites that does perpetuate, you know, very harmful stereotypes. But more than that, it displays sexual violence and abuse. And sure, some people could say, you know, it's acting or it's scripted or whatever that is. But there's plenty of content that's not. There's plenty of content that is glorifying harmful, abusive, violent acts and normalizing them for sexual intimacy. And so many people are seeing pornography at such a young age, and that is really reinforcing, you know, these behaviors and making things normal that aren't normal. And I think it's really important that you don't get flack for saying that, at least not on this channel and this page, because that's largely why we exist, is to help people understand that, you know, so many people just don't know that's true. Before this happened, did you have any awareness of how much, you know, exploitative or non-consensual content material exists online?
No. Yeah. No, not at all. It's not a realm that I've ever dived into. But yeah, to have the amount of women that I have had contact through the End ITEP movement is just crazy. It's so sad. It's great to know that we're developing our own community. And as I said, these men don't realize they're creating an army. But at the same time, it's devastating. Absolutely devastating.
In your opinion, how can not just pornography, but certain online, you know, spaces, forums, communities, how can they shape harmful attitudes around consent and entitlement or violence, which we've spoken about a little bit?
Well, stop making it, I think. It's funny because I was having a chat with somebody the other day and they were asking what the difference was between, the Tina Turner movie, What's Love Got to Do with It? And there's a rape scene in that. But the thought pattern, it's not just an endless movie. She's creating her life story and she's telling that. And it's a experience of, you know, strength and hope. Whereas the porn industry are making material that simulates rape, sexual abuse or violence towards women, not for experience, strength and hope, purely for people to gain sexual gratification from. So in a sense, they're molding inadvertently a society of people getting off on the torture or rape or strangulation of women. That is very different than telling somebody's life story of, here's a young girl, this is what's happened, but look how she's coped with it one way or the other. I think that they do play a major part, as well as these platforms play a major part in almost hibernating this culture, and I think it needs to be eradicated.
Yeah, that's really well said. You know, in addition to the content that's made to, you know, supposedly simulate sexual violence or abuse, there is actual content of rape uploaded, of gang rape uploaded. And sadly, one of the, as a nonprofit, we have a website, and one of the search terms that leads people to some of our content the most is they're searching for rape porn. As a keyword, we see in our Google Analytics that rape porn is a keyword people are often searching. And we have educational content about how harmful that is on our website. And we're grateful they get there to learn about it. But it's a very, very common, popular genre of pornography that is, as you mentioned, fueling a very harmful ideas and perpetuating harmful ideas that fuel sexual violence. Speaking of these websites and platforms, you know, your story was part of a larger CNN investigation into online communities built around quote unquote sleep content, where users shared and consumed videos of unconscious women without their consent. And the investigation, I'm sure many of our listeners have seen this. If you haven't, we can link to that in our show notes to that CNN CNN piece, highly informative, but that investigation also uncovered forums where users exchanged advice about drugging their partners and live streaming the abuse. So not only was this content being uploaded and individuals are learning from it, from watching it, but there were communities of people learning how to commit this type of sexual violence and abuse that you experience personally. And more recently, the platform Motherless, which is the one that was, you know, primarily noted in that CNN piece, was reportedly taken down by Dutch authorities after the allegations involving the non-consensual abuse material. But what was your reaction when you had heard that news?
Yeah, I was thrilled. And I think it's really good to take a minute to pause to say that that has been reviewed and there is an investigation on that. I'm very well aware that this is a whack-a-mole situation. You know, most porn sites have subsections of categories of porn-wise and they don't know it and, you know, those sorts of things. So it's not slowed this campaign down. It's not going to slow down the awareness or the work that needs to be done in the future. It shows what we can do where there is the right type of reporting and the right type of social networking. I mean, 25, 30 years ago, a man wouldn't be able to walk into a pub and say, I think I want to drug and rape my wife. Does anybody want to join me? Unfortunately, there are not the correct and appropriate moderators to these sorts of apps and these sort of platforms, which means that these men are able to easily find each other, build a community and enforce their crimes. So yes, that is absolutely brilliant. And I'm not taking anything away from that, but there's so much more work to be done.
That's right. And, you know, it is a win to have that one site where so much exploitation happens taken down. There is exploitation still happening across platforms all over the internet, as well as offline. And there are communities across the internet where men are still having these conversations. And so there is a lot of work to be done still to eradicate this problem. But it is a win in and of itself, but certainly not something that lets everyone say, okay, we can move on from this. You know, there's so much more work to be done. And as you've become more involved in conversations around these online communities and platforms, you know, what's it been like to, repeatedly visit such a painful part of your own story in order to bring awareness to these issues?
And I'm not saying that this is right, nor am I saying this is helpful, but I'm quite disassociated from my trauma.
Yeah.
My body feels it. It really does. You know, with the FND and the pain and mobility issues and all of that. But I think, my brain, It's as if I'm talking about somebody else. I can relive my story, but and I'm doing a lot of work on that about connecting the emotion to what has happened to me. And at the moment, as a coping mechanism, I've not been able to connect the two. And I know that at some point in time in this journey that I will be able to connect that, but I'm not going to rush myself. I'm grateful to be able to be a voice to the voiceless. And there are many women that have experienced what I have experienced, don't feel like that they can speak out. Just to be able to say to one woman, I understand, as sad as it is, I understand. But I think that it's very personal. Every woman is a very personal situation.
Yeah. And I'm sure you have helped so many women to feel less alone by sharing your experience and your story. Have there been moments for you where, you know, these others sharing their experiences have helped you to feel less alone in what you've gone through?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I met Amanda, because it became real that she wasn't just on the end of a text.
Yeah.
She was a person, and I view her and all these other women in a way in which the men who witch abused them did not. They are people to be loved and supported and cherished and validated. And that's something I'm looking to do, you know, with the support of other people to get us all together, you know, to build this army. It would be absolutely incredible. But It's hard as well, because I probably feel more emotion reading their stories than I do knowing my own.
Yeah.
Crazily.
Yeah. And for any of our listeners, Amanda, we were able to have a conversation with as well recently. She is so incredible. I'm so, so glad to know the two of you have been able to meet in person. And she is also someone who's experienced a similar situation, and her story was shared in that CNN investigation as well. So for any of our listeners interested in seeing, you know, that investigation again, we'll link that in the show notes, as well as a conversation with Amanda as well. And then going back to something you mentioned is, you know, seeing this trauma from others and feeling for that more than yourself. Why do you think that is? I think that's something I've heard from many survivors as I've had these conversations. And I'm curious to know your perspective on why you think that is.
I think for many years, my own well-being, and these were vulnerable young years of me being a young teenage girl, they were always put to one side. So that's a skill, right? You've got to learn that. You've got to learn how to put a boundary in, how to put yourself first. And it's refreshing, but it's something that I'm learning. And I think that's really important. I remember a specialist coming alongside to say, just do one thing a day for yourself. And I thought, God, that sounds so stupid. You know, I'm running around after four children. But she said, just choose one thing, Zoe, for a day for yourself, whether that's a coffee or a dog walk. And I chose to have a bath, half an hour bath of an evening, so I could sit down and I only watched the Netflix episode when I was in that bath. My kids were safe. And after a period of time, I really looked forward to my bath just to have that time. And I think that I'm learning that my needs are important and that I need to recognize what they are, because I'm so used to worrying about somebody else. So I think that with that disassociation, you know, because I think I would have gone crazy of this thing that's happened is kind of over there so I can cope. Slowly, it's getting a bit nearer. I'm understanding on a deeper level. But I think when I hear it for other women, I don't have the capability to even understand how or why somebody would do that to a person. So when I read it, it's so raw, because one, it's happened to this beautiful woman that I am talking to that just thought she was happily married. And two, it brings my situation a little bit closer.
And, you know, as part of a healing journey, I think that makes so much sense, where to survive your own situation for so long, you did have to, you know, make sense of things along the way for yourself. And so I think that is a common experience and makes sense that you would have to kind of keep it at bay until you're able to bring it closer and closer. And, you know, in addition to doing that one thing a day for yourself, having that bath, what else has been part of your healing journey? What has your healing journey looked like so far? And I guess to expand on that, if anyone's in a similar situation, you know, where would you recommend that they start a healing journey?
I think, I mean, here in the UK, I know you can report, but you can choose whether to prosecute. And I do say that because I reported, but didn't prosecute straight away. And it served me because my memories were more real. Not real, but fresh. So I think you know that you've got that. A lot of women have said, God, I wish I'd have done something. It's too late for me now. The fear of, if I report, this situation is going to be taken out of my hands, because let's face it, we're often in a situation that we're unable to control. So we want to keep control, put it back in the box, you know, as much as we can. But I think that starting to treat yourself and to humanize yourself at a time when you have been dehumanized is vital. Again, it's just having a small handful, even one person that you can just learn to be yourself
because your identity is lost in with the marriage. When the marriage breaks, you don't know who you are. You certainly don't know what your future looks like. Your world has essentially been blown up. So I think if you have at least one person in whatever capacity, whatever that looks like, whether it is online or tangible, that you can just bounce your thoughts and feelings off, even if it's in a professional capacity, because we're very often not confident in our decision-making because we don't know how we got to where we got to. We wouldn't have allowed it if we'd have known. So it's all about starting to gain the confidence back, not on your truth, because that's subjective, on the truth, and stand confident in that. I think that's really important to move on and to start to process.
Yeah, that's well said. And, you know, for any survivors that you've witnessed their journeys through healing as well, what, you know, responses from survivors have really stayed with you? What stories from survivors have really stayed with you as you've been on this journey since speaking publicly about your experience?
I mean, many. I think just the size of the women that are out there, that there's these women that are just carrying on with their lives, devoted to their husbands and having their children, and the impact that they're maybe unable to work afterwards. You know, they're struggling to maybe parent, the financial abuse that they find that they are left with, which is similar to me. I just find that they still have the capacity to love. They still have the capacity to want to reach out to me, you know, after what they've gone through. They want to be there for me. And I think that, you know, they'd not let that vile act make them hard. I think that's honourable, because it's very easy to go on that spiral. Some women have drawn strength from their children or looking after an elderly parent.
I remember seeing on one social media post this woman, and she heard what happened to me and she said, I'm off to talk to my six brothers. And I thought, God, that's good. You know, she just wanted to have an open conversation with them about what views were on it. And I think there has been some really courageous women out there, and I've not forgotten them. I've not.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. For anyone listening who may feel, you know, maybe they've heard this conversation and they're thinking, I've been experiencing something in my own relationship, in my own marriage, in my own, you know, long-term relationship, and I'm feeling confused about it because, you know, maybe it didn't feel consensual, or it didn't feel, something didn't feel right about it. What would you want those women to hear?
I think for me, afterwards, I did use various different agencies here within the UK. And it really scared me to know that I was talking to somebody outside of me, because it felt like my control and power was going to be taken away. But they did help with the blurred lines of consent, and they were very good. And I don't know what it's there, what it's like over there for you guys. But I think that sometimes you have to accept the fact that you might have to think outside of yourself from your own understanding.
Yeah.
But very importantly, to be your own advocate, because there are many agencies where they have failed women, many times through the police network, that women have been failed. And it's a shame that we have to be our own advocate in that respect. But I think, again, if you find the right agency or the right person to start breaking down what is happening in your life, that your confused reality starts to become a lot clearer. And therefore, if you are informed, you can make an informed decision. But while you're living with the irrational, it's hard to be rational, because your truth isn't the truth, if you see what I mean. I think that contacting some of these agencies is not as scary as it sounds. And they are set up, it's their bread and butter, to talk to women like myself.
Yeah, well said. And there certainly are many resources available in the U.S. as well. We will link some of them as well in our in this video, but for any of our listeners as well, please feel free to reach out to us if you need a resource. There are many, many, you know, professional, private resources available to you that can help you. And ultimately, we want anyone who's in a potentially dangerous situation to have the resources and help that they need to be able to be safe and to be supported in the situation that they are in. Zoe, is there anything that you wanted to share today that we haven't had a chance to speak about yet?
No, I don't think so. I think you've highlighted, you know, and given me the opportunity to highlight, you know, essentially what we're looking to do with the iCheck movement, because we're looking to end the iCheck and set up campaigns in America. That's in the works now. It's getting so big. And British Columbia, Mexico, and Australia. So I think if many women who can support that and come alongside this campaign is fantastic. As I said, it's too late for me, but the amount of women that it will help, the amount that have come forward is huge.
Yeah.
And it's such a cliche thing to say, you're not alone. And it's so sad. It doesn't even want to fall off my tongue, but we're not alone. And we have to draw on each other's voices as strengths to stand.
That's very well said. And the work of this movement is so important. So thank you, Zoe, for having this conversation with me.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Consider Before Consuming is brought to you by Fight the New Drug. Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and a non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. Check out the episode notes for resources mentioned in this episode. If you find this podcast helpful, consider subscribing and leaving a review. Thanks again for listening. We invite you to increase your self-awareness, look both ways, check your blind spots, and consider before consuming.
Here at Fight the New Drug, we talk a lot about the impact pornography can have on mental health, relationships, sexual health, and the world around us. And if you've felt that impact personally, it's important to know this. You're not alone. That's why Relay exists. Relay is an app designed to give you real support as you work toward lasting change. It connects you with a small, private group of people who understand what you're going through, people who show up when it matters. Relay isn't about shame or judgment. It's about accountability, encouragement, and learning how to move forward together. And if anonymity matters to you, Relay has you covered. No names, just support. If you're ready to stop doing this alone, try Relay for free today at ftnd.org/joinrelay. Can I be honest for a second? A lot of people who listen to this podcast already know they want to quit porn. That's not the problem. The problem is doing it consistently, when no one's watching, when it's difficult, when it's late, when you're stressed. Instead of just relying on willpower, rely on our friends at Relay. Relay gives you structure, tools, support, connection, so you're not fighting alone and starting over every week. If that sounds like what you've been missing, check it out at ftnd.org/joinrelay.
Struggling with compulsive sexual behavior or betrayal trauma can feel isolating, not just for individuals, but for partners and families too. But healing is possible, and you don't have to navigate it alone. From June 25th through the 27th in Nashville, Tennessee, the Hope for Healing Conference brings together individuals in recovery, partners, couples, and professionals for 3 days of expert insights, meaningful conversations, and real connection. You'll hear from experienced voices in the field, gain practical tools for healing, and connect with others who understand what this journey can look like. Whether you're seeking support personally or professionally, this space is designed to meet you where you are. To learn more or register, visit csbdhopeforhealing.org and use code PODCAST25 for 25% off.